You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including a new management plan for the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument and news about Oregon's mail-in voting system. I'm Eric Newman, the news director here at JPR.
I'm Roman Battaglia, science, environment, and politics reporter.
And I'm Jane Vaughn. I'm the housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
Reporter Justin Higginbottom is off today, so we'll start with my conversation with him that we recorded yesterday about changes to the management plan of the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument.
Hey, Justin.
Hey, Eric.
So the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument is about 140,000-acre area of land outside of Ashland on the Oregon-California border. What's the purpose of having a management plan for the monument, and why are land managers writing a new one?
Yeah, so a resource management plan basically guides federal agencies, in this case the Bureau of Land Management, in dealing with all the natural and cultural features on public land. This could involve protecting wildlife habitat or reducing fire risk. This monument, it's right at the intersection of the Cascade, Siskiyou, and Klamath mountain ranges. And so it has some really unique and diverse ecosystems. That's why the monument was first created back in 2000 under President Clinton. Obama later expanded it in 2017. And just for a little bit of background, that expansion was challenged in courts by timber companies because the area not only has these really diverse ecosystems, it also has Oregon and California railroad land forests that were historically logged. Federal courts recently upheld that expansion, and now the BLM wants to decide on how it should be managed for the public. I spoke with someone at the BLM, and they said previously there were three different management plans for the area, and the big change here is that there will be just one plan for the whole monument, and that will provide a kind of more consistent and overarching strategy for the BLM.
Okay, so what's going to change with this new plan?
There's four potential options in this plan. They're labeled A through D, and you can go check them out in detail in the 600-page draft document. Or the BLM has a useful website, a link to the website that summarizes the differences. But those options vary from no action that keeps the status quo to most active management to least active management. And the BLM's preferred option is referred to as moderate active management, and that emphasizes flexibility, according to the agency. In that plan, there are some changes to how it's managed now. First, it would reduce the amount of land managed with a focus on recreation from 9,800 acres to some 400 acres. It would also decrease the area where wildfire fuels reduction is prioritized from over 29,000 acres to nearly 11,000 acres, and with a focus on land a quarter of a mile from at-risk communities. The number of areas of critical environmental concern would also decrease. Those areas are land with important natural resources like sensitive plant species. They would be reduced from 5 to 2, and I asked the BLM about this, and they say that's basically because the management plan already protects those areas.
Okay, so it seems like a lot of these big numbers are getting smaller when it comes to recreation and fuels mitigation and sensitive plant coverage areas. So your story in particular talks about how the acres managed for recreation will drop pretty significantly. That sounds like it might be a bad thing for people like me who like to visit the monument. Will that be bad for recreation?
Yeah, that was one of my first questions as well. But the BLM said that there aren't any proposals to remove or decrease any of the existing recreation opportunities on the monument. So part of the reason for fewer acreage under the special recreation management areas is because they said that an additional layer of management there just isn't needed. There's already safeguards in place. So everything you can do in the monument now, that won't go away. It's sort of like the areas of critical environmental concern, how those are decreasing, but just because, as they say, there's already protections in place for those areas.
Great. Okay, got it. So how can residents weigh in on these proposed changes?
Well, there's public meetings. There's one left at Pinehurst School in the Green Springs community this Saturday if you're in the area. You could also go to our story where we linked the plan so you can check it out. And then you can give public comments on the BLM's website. That ends on July 5th. And the BLM is expected to finalize the plan this fall.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Jumping to you, Roman, ahead of the upcoming primary election in Oregon on May 21st, we had a question about the impacts of a decision made by the USPS earlier this year.
You're talking about the Delivering for America plan, which reduced the amount of services that take place at the local processing plants in Medford and Eugene.
Right. So the consolidation of services has been opposed by local postal workers, community members, Republican and Democratic lawmakers. Oregon is the first state to conduct its elections completely by mail. What did you find out about how these changes will impact election mail?
Well, first I spoke with Jackson County Clerk Chris Walker about how the consolidations to the USPS will affect her office.
It was kind of surprised upon us. In fact, I didn't find out about it until I read it in the newspaper that they were going to have a public meeting. My big concern was, why weren't we reached out to before that?
Now, the major way this could affect election mail is just the timing of mail delivery. Unless the USPS changes how it processes election mail, almost all ballots in Oregon will get sent up to Portland, just like all the other mail. And if your ballot doesn't receive a postmark by election day, it's not going to be counted. For those who don't know, a postmark is the stamp the USPS uses to show when a letter was received by them. So because of the changes in Medford and Eugene, almost all letters sent in Oregon now won't receive that postmark until they arrive in Portland for processing. So to find out more about what's going on inside the USPS, I met up with postal worker Zane Longden. He's the vice president of the local postal workers union, and he works at the processing plant in Medford that was recently downsized.
Our last truck leaves at about 6:30 at night. It's about 5, maybe 6 hours to get up there. Then that mail has to be offloaded, brought into the plant, put into a machine and run. So the possibility of it being postmarked the day that it was actually given to the post office is debatable. It's, you know, 50-50. It's really kind of up in the air.
And so that postmarking process happened a lot quicker before the consolidation, when it only took a couple of hours at most to get from places like Klamath Falls to the plant in Medford. Mm-hmm. So the time it takes for mail to get postmarked is longer now. There's also other things out of the Postal Service's control that could delay the mail on its way to Portland. Things like weather, wildfires, or even a major car crash could impact the mail when they're operating on such tight timelines.
It's not just weather, but, you know, if there's a civil unrest, if there's, you know, there's one road. If something happens to that road, it's blocked. Weather, people, trucks can't get through, trucks can't get through. It's hours to go some other way.
So Longden's referring to a protest that shut down part of I-5 in Eugene last month. If the mail gets delayed on its way to Portland, then those ballots might not get a postmark until after Election Day and they won't be counted.
So what did the USPS have to say about these concerns?
Yeah, a spokesperson for the USPS declined to be interviewed, but in an email, they said that the Postal Service plans for different weather conditions throughout the year. According to their report on the 2022 election year, on average, it took less than 2 days for ballots nationwide to be delivered between voters and elections officials. I asked Jackson County Clerk Chris Walker about how many ballots they've received in the past that arrived late.
It's not a huge amount. It's not even, I would say not even, it's about half a 1%, so it's pretty minimal.
We also got some big news this week about how these mail center consolidations are rolling out across the country. And the Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, announced that he's going to be pausing any further consolidations under this national plan, at least until next January. This is in response to a letter sent by 26 senators earlier this month. I talked to one of the letter signers, Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley, about his concerns.
We are told that mail that is sent to the sorting center in Portland will be postmarked in Portland. That's a problem. So I just want folks to know, if you're mailing your mail on the your vote on the last day, mail it a day earlier. Mail it several days earlier. Drop it off in a drop box.
So it sounds like it's probably too late to be returning your ballot in the mail.
Yeah, if you live in southern Oregon, yes. Chris Walker said that if you're returning your ballot by mail, you should do it no later than a week before the election, which was last Tuesday. If you still have your ballot, the best option is to drop it off at one of the official drop boxes around your county before 8 p.m. on the 21st. That means you know it'll be counted. And you can find a list of those on your county clerk's website or the Secretary of State's website.
Okay, got it. Thanks, Roman.
Yeah.
So, Jane, you wrote a story this week about the budget at the Medford School District for the upcoming school year. Give us some background about what's going on there.
Sure. So the district is facing a $15 million budget shortfall over the next 2 years. And the district officials say that's happening for a lot of different reasons, declining enrollment. They say there's inadequate state funding, inflation, the COVID emergency money is ending for schools, and they say they've had an increase in special education enrollment, which is more expensive. And they're not alone in this. There are a bunch of other school districts throughout the state who are also struggling with funding issues right now. We know that the Ashland School District is going to lay off about 19 staff at the end of this school year, too.
So what happened this week?
They had a meeting on Thursday night, last night, of Medford's budget committee and the school board, and they basically approved the proposed budget for the upcoming school year, the 24-25 school year. And it had some pretty big cuts. Obviously, they're trying to reduce that $15 million shortfall. So they cut $7.5 million from the budget. There's going to be a reduction of over 32 full-time employees, so that is going to be mostly through attrition and reassignment, according to the district, but three people are going to lose their jobs. Those reductions include some assistant principals, 10 elementary school teachers, a bunch of teacher librarians in the middle and high schools. The budget also says that the district will use $2 million from its reserves to try to help out. They're going to hold off on their planned construction for the Innovation Academy building. They're going to reduce their funding for trainings. They're going to reduce their funding for summer programming. So the budget was approved last night, but it's got some pretty big cuts in it. And some people are still upset about the things that the district decided to cut. So teachers, parents, students spoke out against the budget last night as well.
Okay. Is this budget final?
Almost, but not quite. So as I said, it was approved last night by the budget committee and the school board. The vote was 10-4, so it was split. But then the budget still has to be officially adopted by the school board at the end of June. I'm expecting that it will be adopted because almost all of the school board members, except for one, approved it last night. So my expectation is they will approve it, adopt it rather, at the end of June. And the interesting thing, Superintendent Brett Champion was saying that as hard as this budget is with all the cuts, like, this doesn't even solve all the district's problems. They've still got this $15 million shortfall that's partially addressed. But he was saying if things don't improve, next year's budget is going to be much, much worse. They've said they're going to consider consolidating elementary schools due to declining enrollment. So they're going to start that process of consideration this fall. So I think, you know, as hard as this year's budget was, next year's could also be really rough.
Okay. We're going to pivot to one other story that you worked on this week. You published a story about a new internship in Medford for people experiencing homelessness. Tell us about that.
Sure. So the program is run by Rogue Retreat, which is a homeless services provider here in Southern Oregon. And the program they started is called Hope Kitchen. And so it's basically an internship for people who are in Rogue Retreat's programs. And the goal is to help people get more skills in the food service industry by working in the kitchen at the Kelly Shelter in Medford, which is run by Rogue Retreat. And they're hoping this will be one solution to some of the barriers that homeless people can face to getting hired. And so it's nice to have potential. A positive story. I cover homelessness a lot, and so it's nice to have a potential solution to address some of these barriers.
So what is the goal of this program, and how does it work?
Sure. So as I said, the goal is to get people who are experiencing homelessness some job skills, some employment history, make it easier for them to get employed. I think things like working in kitchens and food service are often considered like easy entry-level jobs, but you still need skills and certifications. So homeless people are especially can have some difficulty finding employment. Maybe they haven't worked in a while. They don't have a resume. So they're trying to bridge that gap here. So it's an 8-week internship. By the end, they get their food handler's card, their ServeSafe certification. They get training in the kitchen. They get knife skills, time and temperature logs. They spend some time at the dish station. They learn how to cook, how to plan meals, all these things. And then I know that Rogue Retreat is also collaborating with WorkSource in Medford to help residents with resumes and interview skills. And so again, the goal is to help them go get employed in the community.
Okay, and you covered this story right after the first group of people went through this program. How's it been going so far?
So far, so good. They started in March. They've had one group of interns graduate already, and there's another group starting the next session on Tuesday. Four people started the internship the first round, three people completed it, and two are already employed. One of them is actually employed at Hope Kitchen itself. So his name is Robert Renfro. He had been living in his car in Medford with his wife, got a bed at the Kelly Shelter, got the internship, and he's now a permanent full-time employee at the Kelly Shelter as a kitchen assistant. So that's kind of the goal as with the internship as they move forward.
Nice. Well, you can see that full story on our website. And that's going to do it for the debrief this week. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments about our coverage and suggestions for things that we should cover in the future. That's at ijpr.org. You can find this program and more on our website at jeffexchange.org or all the other platforms. Thanks for joining us.